Okay, so what I'd like to tell you about today is what we know about how the visual system responds to dim lights. And in particular, what I'm going to emphasize is how the rod photoreceptors provide the input to the visual system at low light levels, are able to detect single absorbed photons, and what we know about how the circuitry processing the rod signals makes use of these single photon responses. So why is this a question of interest? Well, one reason is this is one of several cases in which sensory performance reaches or approaches fundamental physical limits. In this case, light comes in discrete packets, and the visual system is limited more by the division of light into these discrete packets than it is by anything that happens within the system itself, by any biological noise or inefficiencies. These examples where sensory system reaches or approaches a fundamental limit pose very strict constraints on the underlying biophysical mechanisms. And we can use those constraints as sort of a guide to how we investigate how those biophysical mechanisms work. And I'll come back to that. It'll be sort of a recurring theme throughout what I'll tell you today. So we'll come back to that several times. So before I go too much further with that, let me introduce the retina itself and the rod photoreceptors. I should say clearly, stop me if you've got questions about things. I have one favor to ask if you do have a question, which make sure you get my attention. I have no direction sensing in my hearing, so I'll be looking off this way and have no idea who's asking a question and what you're asking. And if you do that, I reserve the right to edit your question and turn it into the one I want to answer rather than the one that you're asking. So just make sure you get my attention. So this is an EM picture of a piece of frog retina. So there's a lens, which would be way down here in this picture, which projects an image of the visual world onto this dense array of photoreceptors. These long cylinders here are the rod photoreceptors, which are exquisitely sensitive to very dim lights. And tucked in between the rods, so here, 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 are the cones, which mediate vision up at higher light levels. They provide the inputs upon which color vision is based, provide better temporal acuity than the rods. So you can see right away that the retina is pretty interested in harvesting incident photons. You've got this dense array of rod outer segments, so it really wants to capture any photon that's incident on the retina. The signals, so the transduction, that is the conversion of electrical signals, of light into electrical signals, takes place here in the photoreceptor layer. Those signals are passed through several layers of cells within the retina before they're passed on to the optic nerve and then to the brain.
Can you give us a length scale?
Yeah, so the length of one of these outer segments is about 50 microns.
They're quite narrow.
Yeah, they're something like 8 microns wide. And I'll show you some closer up in a little bit. So there are a couple points I'd like to emphasize about the retina. One is that it doesn't act like a camera. That is, its job is not to take a snapshot of the visual scene and to pass that on to the brain. Instead, it passes on to the brain a highly processed view of the visual input. The simple way to make that point is the output cells of the retina, down here, called retinal ganglion cells. Each of these is sensitive to some region in space. And a given region in space is reported to the brain by something like 10 or 15 different ganglion cells. Okay, so 10 or 15 ganglion cells that are sensitive to this region of space. Each one. In fovea, you have overlapping receptive fields, and particularly in peripheral retina, you very clearly have overlapping receptive fields. In the very center of the fovea, you may not, but as soon as you get to parafovea, then you. Pardon me?
Which is 2, 3 degrees.
Yeah, a couple degrees off, then you clearly do. And one of the reasons you do there is you have cells that are reporting signals upon which color vision is based. So they're telling you something about relative distribution of light across wavelengths. And you have ganglion cells that are not telling you about distribution of light across wavelengths. They're just telling you how much total light fell in this region of space. Those signals go to very different places in the brain and form the basis of very different computations in the brain. So your perception of motion is dominated by non-chromatic mechanisms, just based on total light intensity. So that's a good example. The main point I wanted to make is some given region of space is sampled by multiple ganglion cells, and each of these ganglion cells is reporting the result of a different computation to the brain. So you have motion-sensitive ganglion cells, you have ganglion cells that are telling you about distribution of what light across wavelengths, you have ganglion cells that are telling you about total light intensity irrespective of its distribution across wavelengths. Each of these different types of ganglion cells then provides those inputs to a specific place in the brain that's interested in those signals. So what does that tell us about the retina? Well, it says that the retina is doing significant computations on the visual input. It's not just taking a snapshot and sending the snapshot onto the brain and saying, deal with this. It's reporting to the brain the result of something like 10 to 15 different computations based on the photoreceptor signals. And the brain then constructs this visual world based on the result of those computations.
The photoreceptors are all the same?
They're rods and cones, which are very different, and then there are three different types of cones in our retina. And there's some subtle differences between the different types of cones, but you don't have you can think about the photoreceptors as basically taking a snapshot, acting like a camera, and reporting that snapshot to the retina, which then does these computations. So one of the reasons for studying the retina then is you have computations of significance for visual function that are taking place in the circuitry, and we have access to the underlying mechanisms. So our general goal is basically to take some task that we know is of functional significance, track it through the retina, and understand how that task is implemented by the underlying biophysical mechanisms that are operating here. So both in the transduction process and the photoreceptors, but also in the processes that are taking place within the retinal circuitry. And so let me emphasize what we know from behavioral work about the sensitivity of this tissue, and that is that we know, and I'll talk about the behavioral stuff in a minute, but we know that a single photon coming in and activating a single molecule in one of these rod photoreceptors generates a signal that reaches perception. Okay, so it's a case in which activation of a single molecule generates a signal that's large enough that we can actually detect that behaviorally. And I'll summarize some of the evidence for that in a little bit. So it's a pretty striking example where the system has really been geared up to solve this particular task. Okay, so this just emphasizes the two points that I just made, that essentially, why are we interested in studying the retina? Well, one is we have significant computations in the retinal circuitry and the opportunity to relate those to underlying biophysical mechanisms. And the second is that this is a very clear case where our sensitivity to some signal in the outside world reaches fundamental limits. And that tells us that that really acts as a guide to how we investigate the system. It acts as a guide in two ways. One is it poses a set of very precise experimental questions. If I go record from this cell somewhere in the retina, I better be able to explain how this cell responds to single photons, because we know behaviorally that you can detect them. If I can't see it in the cell, then I'm doing something wrong experimentally. It also poses a set of ways of getting at the system theoretically. That is, it suggests that you should think about the system as being sort of well-designed for the task of detecting single photons. And that really serves as a way to think about kind of how is the system geared up to do this.
Is there any reason why the receptors are a few layers back? Why are not they right at the beginning of the receptor? Seems like the neurons, et cetera, in general.
Why are things... Ask the question once more.
Why are the photoreceptors not closer to where the light is coming from?
Why isn't the whole thing basically flipped around? It's not completely clear why that's true. So the thing you worry about is as light comes in, it gets scattered around and you've degraded your spatial resolution. The one place you care about that in the fovea, so in the center of your visual system, is where you have the best spatial acuity. Actually, your spatial acuity off peripherally is really bad. In the fovea, you move all of this stuff out of the way. And you just push it to the side, and light has direct access to the photoreceptors.
So there are no ganglion cells covering
it? The ganglion cells are pushed out to the side. So there's a process that will say, come out of a cone in the fovea and go off to the side, and it'll reach.
If you look at the fovea, there would be the ganglion cell on top of it, or less dense?
There are none. The whole thing is just thinned out, so you've got a little layer of photoreceptors and then processes that stream out to the sides. And then as soon as you get off to the side, you've got this stack of ganglion cells that are reporting what's happening in the fovea. It still doesn't really answer your question. It says that the place you worry about that question, you've found some kind of ad hoc solution. And that's one argument. Right. So that is one argument. There's another argument is the photoreceptors, it turns out, turn over this. So the rods turn over the cylindrical piece. So the thing is about 30 days old. So they're constantly shedding debris off the top end. And you might not want that debris to be accumulating in your light path. That stuff is actually awful in terms of scattering light because it's full of visual pigment and all kinds of stuff. Invertebrates have done this the other way around. So in flies and other insects, the photoreceptors face forward. So that's why I'm hesitant to give an answer that says this is the answer, because there are other animals that have found other answers. And particularly gotten around this problem. But there are several things like metabolism, like the shedding of pieces of the outer segments that suggest why it's happened this way. It's in the photoreceptors by far. Yeah. We can talk a little bit. When we talk about how the photoreceptors work, remind me and I'll mention why they are so costly energetically. Okay, so those are the sort of two of the reasons why we're interested in looking at the retina. I put up on the board over here, you can't really see it, but sort of a plan for the day, and I'll just go through it. So what I'd like to do is start by reviewing some of the behavioral evidence that the visual system can detect a few absorbed photons. Spend maybe 20 minutes or half an hour going through that. And then from that, we can think about what constraints do those behavioral experiments pose for the retina in particular. Then we'll come back and talk about how the rod photoreceptors transduce absorbed photons into electrical signals, what the evidence is that they can detect single absorbed photons. Then I'll talk about sources of noise in the rods and the implications of these sources of noise for visual sensitivity. And we'll sort of march through each of the sources of noise and talk about how they constrain or how they limit the sensitivity of vision. And somewhere in the middle of that, maybe around 10:45 or 11, we can take a quick break so you guys aren't just exhausted by things. And then finally, if there's time at the end, I'd like to say a little bit about what we know about how the circuitry in the retina reads out the photoreceptor responses. Yeah.
Just general questions to make sure that two things I don't really get. One is, what do you mean by a snapshot? Like, what is the time of the
You'll see that in a while, but essentially what I mean is that maybe a snapshot isn't quite right, but it's not like a video camera. You're not just providing a continuous report. The retina is not providing to the brain a report of light intensity as a function of time in this region of space. It's reporting, say, an estimate of motion. So one type of ganglion cell that's reporting from this region of space might tell you an estimate of motion. Another one might tell you not just light intensity, but distribution across wavelengths. The photoreceptor output is more like a continuous just light intensity over time. But the circuitry in the... Right. Right.
Usually when we talk about vision, it's the cone, right? Cone for their vision. I mean, that's it. So what will be the similarity between the two processes? Are they similar? Like, what will be
the... Mechanistically, the rods and cones work in a similar way. There are clearly substantial differences. So the underlying mechanisms are the same things are in place, but they're tweaked such that the kinetics of the responses in the rods are much slower and the rods are much more sensitive to a small amount of light than the cones. The circuitry following the photoreceptors is very different for the rods and the cones. In particular, there's a lot of circuitry devoted to combining signals from different cone types to serve as a substrate for color vision. So taking the difference between signals in cones that are sensitive to long wavelength light and signals in cones that are sensitive to, say, short wavelength light, and providing signals that you form color vision based on. So there are clearly big differences once you get beyond the photoreceptors themselves and the circuitry. And we can talk a little bit about what we know about some of the differences between the photoreceptors themselves after I go through how the rods work. Okay, other things? Okay, so let me summarize a little bit about what we know about the behavioral evidence that the visual system can detect a few photons. The first observation along these lines was actually made by Conrad Lorenz, the early part of the century. And what Lorenz realized was that adjust the energy in a just detectable flash of light, if you divide it up into photons, meant that that light flash contained a relatively small number of photons incident on the front of the eye. Okay, so the basic experiment, very simple. Take a light flash from some calibrated source. You have to give somebody a point to fixate on. So we talked about the fovea being sort of very specialized. One of the specializations of the fovea is for cone vision. So like astronomers have known this for years, right? If you want to see a very dim star, you don't look right at it. You look at something that's bright next to it, and you put the dim star off, something like 5 degrees off the center of your visual system. So if you want to probe rod vision, you need to provide a point to fixate, to put the fovea on, and then go probe slightly away from the center. So you've got this fixation point, you've got a target here. The target covers something like 500 rods in the retina. And then you simply change the strength of the target until you can just barely see it. And what you find is, when you've done that, that target is producing something like 100 photons incident on the front of the eye. Our estimate...
How do you get this data?
Pardon me?
How do you get this data?
So you just ask how much energy is being delivered to the front of the eye. You know it's 500 nanometer photons and divided up into photons. Something like 5 to 15% of the photons that are incident on the front of the eye are absorbed by rod photoreceptors in the retina. Okay, so if I put in 100 photons, on average I'm getting something like 5 to 15 photons absorbed in the retina. At these light levels, it doesn't. If you turn the light up, it does. So if you go outside today, the percentage goes way down. Yeah.
So this is the percentage at very low.
Right. Right. This is the percentage for dark adapted visual system. So sit in a dark room for half an hour and then do the experiment. So that tells us that we can see a light that's like something like 5 to 15 absorbed photons spread over 500 rods. It tells us right away that individual rods must be able to generate responses to single absorbed photons. The probability of a rod getting a photon is very low. But it doesn't really get it at what the limiting sensitivity of the visual system is, because we don't know this fraction of photons incident on the cornea that are absorbed very well. That's just too much of an error bar on that 5 to 15%. And that turns out, for various reasons, to be hard to really get at well. Okay? So, a better version of this experiment was done in the 40s by Hechler and Perrin. What they did was, rather than just asking for this single flash, it turns out that the ganglion cells ganglion cells collect signals from many rods. Okay, that's the first thing. No, the ganglion cells in the region of the retina that they were probing collect input from about 500 rods. They didn't know this at the time, but that turned out to be true. Okay, so they did. In all of these experiments, people would play around with the size of the spot until sensitivity seemed best. And 500 rods turns out to be about the place where your sensitivity is highest. And that's probably because that spot just fills the receptive field of a single ganglion cell. If you go smaller, it hurts you because you're not making use of the full collecting area of the ganglion cell. So, kind of looking back retrospectively, the reason they used 500 rods is because that's about as much, that's about the right size to fill the receptive field of a single ganglion cell. They vary dramatically in size as you move away from the fovea. So way out peripherally, a ganglion cell would collect from 20 or 30,000 rods. Where these experiments were done, which are about 7 degrees off center, they're about 500 rods. And they vary a bit from ganglion cell type to ganglion cell type as well. So the type of ganglion cell that is likely to be subserving this behavior has a receptive field size of about 500 rods. Okay, so Hechler and Perrin did an experiment which got them around not knowing the sort of quantum efficiency, that is, fraction of photons that were absorbed. What they did was, again, a subject goes into a dark room, gets completely dark adapted, you deliver dim lights, and you measure the probability that the flash was seen as a function of the flash strength. Very similar experiment. Here are some of their results. So essentially identical experiment all set up, and what's plotted here is percentage of flashes seen as a function of the number of photons at the cornea. Okay, and the symbols here are their measured points. So the first thing I'd like you to notice is that there's a pretty broad transition between a flash down here that's rarely seen and a flash up here that's almost always seen. So it's a factor of at a factor of 50 or something like that in flash strength. Okay? So what they said is, well, we can describe this broad transition from the Poisson fluctuations that govern photon absorption. Okay, so a flash here that's seen half of the time, it's seen half of the time because on 50% of the trials, Poisson fluctuations caused it to be a little bit brighter than on average. And on 50% of the trials, Poisson fluctuations caused it to be a little dimmer. And you only see the times when it fluctuated and produced more absorbed photons. Okay? That was their supposition about why there's this gradual transition. The smooth curves are fits from a Poisson distribution. And let me just go through how they do the fits. So what they said is, if we take this notion seriously, and I assume that it takes some threshold number of absorbed photons to see the flash, and you're being entirely, then the probability of seeing the flash is governed by Poisson statistics, then the probability of seeing the flash should just be the probability that you got theta or more absorbed photons, where P of N is a Poisson distribution. Pardon me?
Single interval discrimination, just at random you see either a flash or no flash, and then you say what it was?
In their case, you actually don't have to say, all you have to do is sit there and say, I saw it. Okay, I saw that one. So you're not actually saying that you don't see them. You can hear the shutter go off, so you know exactly when to pay attention.
And sometimes there is a flash.
And sometimes there's a blank. So the blanks are there to make sure that you're not cheating.
Okay.
And we'll get back to, and the problems with that, and we'll get back to that in a second. So the probability, so N is number of photons absorbed, and what they're saying is the probability of seeing the flash is just a cumulative Poisson series starting at some threshold theta. Okay, N, the average of N is going to be some quantum efficiency times the average number of photons at the cornea. Okay, what they get from this analysis, so if I plot probability of seeing versus the log of the number of photons at the cornea, I get a series of curves where the shape of the curve is governed by what I choose for this threshold theta. And if I plot probability of seeing versus log of the number at the cornea, the position of these curves is determined by the quantum efficiency, but not their shape. Okay? So that's critical. So what they're doing is, what they want to do is, remember, the quantum efficiency was the thing that was hard to estimate. So now they can generate these curves, slide them along until they fit their data, and the shape will determine this threshold number of absorbed photons required for seeing. Okay, so that allows them to sort of separate out the factor that's hard to know from the factor that they'd like to get at. And essentially what they're using is a second moment of the distribution, the variability in the distribution, to get an estimate of the threshold rather than using the mean itself. So the three curves that I plotted here fitting their data are for thresholds of 2, 7, and 12 absorbed photons. Each of those has a different quantum efficiency. So I've slid each of these curves along the log, the number of photons at the cornea axis, till they coincide about 50% correct. Okay? So the conclusion from this analysis then is everything seems consistent with this model that you're governed by Poisson fluctuations, the number of absorbed photons, and it's consistent with the threshold of something like, and the various subjects they did, 5 to 7 absorbed photons. So I think they got 5, 6, and 7 in the 3 subjects they did this experiment on. Is that relatively clear? Okay. So from this analysis, then you get a better estimate of the threshold number of photons absorbed required to see, something like 5 to 7 photons, again spread over 500 rods. There's a problem with this, and this gets to what Sebastian was asking about, is there's some sort of arbitrary criterion that you can set as an observer as to when you say that you saw the flash. And it's a little better than being arbitrary because they train the observer. So basically, the observer goes in the room. If the observer is just saying, every time the shutter goes off, says, oh, I saw that one, then they go in, beat him over the head, said, no more of that. The observer raises his criterion and is a little bit more careful about making sure absolutely that they saw the flash before it's delivered. But it's still, that criterion is kind of hidden here. And if you think about the system, really, you think there's some noise in the system, and if you really push sensitivity, you'd like to come down to where you are making some false positives. Occasionally you're saying, I saw a flash when none was given. And that would give you a better estimate of the limiting sensitivity of the system. Okay, a simple example of this problem came from experiments by Horace Barlow some number of years later. What Barlow did, just to sort of illustrate the problem with this criterion, was he allowed observers to say probably. Okay, so you hear a shutter go off, you can say, I probably saw the flash, or I definitely saw the flash. And the threshold, and again, so this is again, percent of flashes seen versus log number of photons at the cornea. What Barlow found is the threshold for probably was much better than the threshold for yes, as you'd expect. Okay, but it came with a cost. And that is occasionally, in the absence of any light, you say you saw something. Okay? And that's because you've sort of freed yourself to really push down to your limits of sensitivity. He turned this...
So blue is from the trials where there was a flash, and red is from the flash.
So blue is, yes, I definitely saw the flash. Red is, same trials, I probably saw it. So it's basically just... You're allowed two different criteria. You can say, I probably saw that one, or you can say, I definitely saw it.
But you always know that there wasn't.
You always know.
Because you heard the shutter.
You know that.
Unless you have some catch trials.
You have catch trials in there, and those are, so that's what these are, right? These are the trials where the shutter went off, but nothing happened. And if you say yes, you never get fooled. If you're saying yes, but you do get fooled when you say probably. Okay? So occasionally, if you are freed to really dig down and try to see something, you know, that sort of goes... What's that? Right. All of these are hard. I mean, none of these are bright lights. You can say either yes or probably on any given trial.
So yeah. Why do these curves converge to the same?
Because that's 100%.
But at 100%, you always say yes and never say probably.
Yeah, so I may have the task wrong. It's probably two separate experiments in which you're either allowed to say probably, interleaved with being able to say yes.
Okay, that's a two different criteria.
And the whole point here is that you're modulating the subject's criterion, and you're seeing that the criterion trades with the threshold that you estimate. Okay, so it's still not the right way to do the experiment, but it highlights that there is this somewhat arbitrariness in the criterion. No one has quite done that, but there's one more experiment that I'll show you which is slightly better, which is so Barbara Sackett, 20 years after this, did an experiment where what she asked you to do is rate the intensity of every flash on a scale of 0 to 6. Okay, so you hear the shutter go off, every flash you attach a rating to, somewhere between 0 and 6. 0 is I didn't see it, 6 is I definitely saw it, 1 through 5, everything in between. Okay, the reason she chose 6 classes is, or 7 classes is, that's a sort of well-known from psychology, that's about the most number of things that you can classify. If you start generating 10 or 20 classes, it's sort of arbitrary distinctions between them at that point. So, same experiment, except now, instead of saying yes or probably, you're saying somewhere between 0 and 6 for every flash. And she then, show you what her data looks like. So here's data from Sackett's experiment. What's plotted here is probability of seeing the flash. In this case, it's probability of attaching a certain rating to the flash. So this is a rating of 1, a rating of 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Okay, versus log of the number of photons at the cornea. And actually what these are cumulative probabilities. So this is the probability of getting a rating of 1 or more given this flash strength. This is the probability of getting a rating of 2 or more given the flash strength. 3 or more, 4 or more. She did that for the purpose of her analysis.
Okay.
So the curves here, the curves are cumulative Poisson theory. Now I'll get to those in just a second.
They should go all the way to 0, right? They should all go to origin.
She added in some dark photon-like noise events. Okay, I'll get to those in just a second. But let me make sure it's clear what the points are. So the thing she measured was, you give a flash, you attach a rating to each flash. Then she measures the probability that you give a rating of 1 or more for a number of flash strengths. So this is the probability, given I give you no light at all, probability that you give a rating of 1 or more. Given that I deliver something like 55 photons to the cornea, this is the probability of giving a rating of 1 or more, and a little higher flash strength. That's the probability of 1 or more. This is the probability of 2 or more, 3 or more, so on. Okay, so then she fit her data, assuming that, first of all, that there's some dark noise in the system. And then she can describe this dark noise as an equivalent rate of photon-like noise events. Okay, so you basically refer all the noise back to noise in the photoreceptors and assume that that noise takes a form of something like photon-like events in the rods. And she assumed that she could attach to each of these ratings, 1 through 6, some number of absorbed photons, some effective threshold. And the assumption she made to fit the model that best fit this data was that when you say a rating of 1, that means you got 1 absorbed photon. When you attach a rating of 2, you got 2 absorbed photons. 3 was 3 absorbed photons, and so on. Okay? So what she has then is she's got this set of curves, which are cumulative Poisson series, exactly as I showed you a second ago. The relative shapes of the curves are fixed. There's nothing I can do to change the shapes of the curves. I can slide the whole family of curves along the x-axis by changing the quantum efficiency. But I can't change them relative to each other. And then she slides them along and finds the best fit to her data. Okay? And it fits reasonably well. And you can play with her data and try to fit it and find a better set of parameters. It's difficult to find one that works much better. Yeah?
Do you know if there's much variation among the observers?
I was just going to get that. So in this observer, which is actually Sackett herself, a rating of 1 was attached to 1 absorbed photon. She also did this on another informed observer. That is another observer who knew what the experiment was. Things were similar, except in that case, a rating of 1 was associated with 2 absorbed photons. And a rating of 2 was associated with 3 absorbed photons, and so on. And then she did one naive observer who had no idea what the... So probably the informed observer was her graduate student, and the naive observer was somebody she grabbed in the hallway. And the naive observer... Actually, I'm not sure whether it was naive or the informed observer, but one of them, a rating of 2 was associated with one absorbed photon, and one of them, a rating of 3, was associated with one absorbed photon. So more or less the picture holds up. There's a little bit of a discrepancy in whether literally you can adopt criteria such that your rating is associated with the number of absorbed photons. There's a little bit of variability there from observer to observer. And it's clearly a set of experiments you would like to see done more, and you'd like to see more data, because the implications are pretty important. But she did a number of other things to sort of check consistency here, and it seems reasonable. You know, it's not clear that she got everything right, but it doesn't seem dramatically wrong. Yeah. I'll get to doing things like that later, but just I just wanted to take you through the history of the behavioral. So most of this was done before it was possible to do any electrical recordings from the retina. Not these experiments, but certainly the Hexley and Perrin experiments were done kind of when the very first recordings from the retina were just being made, and things definitely were not at a state where you could do really low light level experiments at that time. Yeah. This is all 500 nanometers. Yeah. Pardon me?
Can they come on the wavelength?
It depends. Yeah. It will. So the quantum efficiency will depend on wavelength, but nothing else will. So the only thing that depends on wavelength is the coupling of light incident on the cornea to being absorbed by the rods. Once the photon gets absorbed, it doesn't matter. Okay. So. It would be, and I'm not sure why. She talks about the equivalent to alternative force choice. So she talks about her data in that context, but she didn't do it that way. And I don't.
But you said I'll get more out of this because it's
like. I think the reason she did this is because it connects back to the frequency of seeing the Hechsler and Perrin experiments. It looks, she can analyze her data in a very similar way. It connects back to that sort of historical literature. But. A two alternative thing would be a better, I think would be a clearer way to do things. And I don't think anyone has done that. Yeah? No, so she has two, she's got this family of curves that she generates from cumulative Poisson series. And she's got only two parameters, she's got actually three things she uses to fit. One is the association of a rating with a number of photon-like events, either true absorbed photons or noise events. Okay, so when she says a rating of, in this case, a rating of 1 corresponds to one event, whether that's from photon absorption or whether it's a noise event. The two other free parameters are dark noise, but the same dark noise associated with all the curves. And the overall position of the family of curves on the x-axis, which is the quantum efficiency. So one reason for sort of trusting her results is it is, you know, she's got this whole family of curves that are fitting the set of data, and she doesn't have a lot of free parameters there.
But there are no points in the middle. Points.
You'd like to see more points, yeah. They're hard experiments, you know, in her defense. The first thing you have to do is... Right. What you're relying on for the shape really is the previous experiments, like Hechsler and Perrin's, where the shape was nailed down. But they are a little bit difficult because the first thing you have to do is sit in the dark for 45 minutes or an hour doing nothing. And then you have to sit there for another hour really attending to the task and really paying attention to what you're doing. And based on that, you get maybe a data point. So it's a little difficult to, you know, to really concentrate on it for that long. I don't want to defend her, because I think it would be nice to see a lot more data here, and it would be nice to see more subjects and so on. But her results are suggestive that you can literally count absorb photons. That is, when you attach a rating to a flash, that rating corresponds to the number of photon absorptions plus noise events in the pool of photoreceptors that you're paying attention to. Okay? Okay, so let me sort of summarize what that's basically where the behavioral stuff stands today. And I think that, hopefully I'll push towards the need for more behavioral experiments as we go on. And clearly the kind of questions you've been asking also push towards the same thing. But the field, I think, has kind of stopped there because the picture seems relatively tidy. And I think most people don't quite understand Sackett's experiment and tend not to. They sort of go back to Hechsler and Prehn and say, Hechsler and Prehn told us that we can absorb a small number of photons. That's all we need to know. But Sackett's experiment clearly goes further than that and suggests that not only can you detect a small number of photons, you can literally count absorbed photons. And we'll talk about what that means in terms of photoreceptors a bit. So what does this stuff mean for the retina? So first of all, it's quite clear from behavioral literature that single rods must be able to reliably detect single absorbed photons. I think there's no question about that being true. So if we think about the phototransduction process here in the rod outer segments, one of the questions we'll ask right away is how do the rods reliably detect a single absorbed photon? Sackett's experiment suggests that if you can count photons, that means the rods must generate distinguishable responses to absorption of one and two photons. Okay, they have to provide the signals upon which allow you to count absorbed photons. So we'll also like to see if the rods do that. The single photon responses generated in the photoreceptors have to be reliably transmitted through the retina. So the synapses that allow one cell to communicate with another must be reliable. This is a bit in contrast to studies of central synapses. So I think Chuck Stevens is coming in a week or two or something like that. So Chuck, one of the things Chuck may tell you about is that central synapses can be unreliable. Here we clearly have a case where synapses are very reliably transmitting very small signals. And finally, when we get to the ganglion cells, we know that absorption of a single photon must produce some noticeable change in the pattern of activity flowing from the retina to the brain. Okay, so there's a challenge here for how we think about neural coding. And I'd like to make the case that these are sort of three really important issues in neuroscience. And here we have ability to study these issues in the context of a functionally important task, and a task where we've got these sort of guides for how we think about the task. The guide is, we know what the goal is. We need to explain how the retina is able to respond to single absorbed photons. So it both guides the experimental questions that we ask, and also guides how we think theoretically about how the system is working. So, you know, it's easy to generate models for how the retina takes signals from the photoreceptors to the ganglion cells that will corrupt the single photon responses and lose everything. And I'll talk later about how much we can constrain the retinal readout of the rod responses based on these observations about reliability of the visual system as a whole. Okay, so what I'm going to focus on primarily today, then, is talking about the transduction process, is how absorbed photons get converted into electrical signals. And I hope to touch a little bit on the sort of readout within the retina and how that works. Okay, any questions about where we are so far? In these cases, it's one eye, and they're working in a very particular place of that retina. Okay, so what I'd like to turn to now is spend maybe the next 15 or 20 minutes talking about how the rod photoreceptors work, sort of basic operation of the rods. From there, then, we'll turn to evidence that the rods can detect single photons and talk about sources of noise in the rods. And eventually, we'll work our way back to this behavioral story and try to relate what we see at the level of single photoreceptors to sort of limits to behavioral sensitivity. So we can, just to show you what an individual rod looks like a little bit more clearly. So here's a rod that's been removed from the retina. This is a rod from a tiger salamander retina. And you can see that the thing has several distinct regions. There's this cylindrical piece out here, which is called the outer segment. There's the inner segment here, and the synaptic terminal down at the other side. So the outer segment out here is highly specialized for detecting incident light. Okay, so that's where light gets absorbed, gets converted into an electrical signal. The inner segment has the nucleus and the mitochondria and the DNA and all the normal sort of cellular machinery. And at the synaptic terminal down here is where the cell communicates with other cells in the retina, tells them how much light is falling on the outer segment. Okay? The way the cell works, I sort of diagrammed over here. So in darkness, there is a current that flows into the outer segment. And the current is carried by sodium ions that are moving in solution. So sodium ions are moving down their electrochemical gradient into the outer segment. And they're flowing through channels in the surface membrane, so pores of microscopic dimension in the surface membrane of the outer segment. And those sodium ions are then pumped out of the inner segment. So here's one of the sources of metabolism of the cell. It has to pump the sodium ions out of the inner segment, expend energy to do that. And it's expending that energy to maintain the electrochemical gradient that allows the sodium ions to flow in through into the outer segment. This circulating dark current serves to set the voltage difference across the membrane to about minus 40 millivolts. Okay, so the inside is about minus 40 millivolts more negative compared to the outside. And at this voltage, the cell is continuously releasing a chemical transmitter from the synaptic terminal. Okay, so it's constantly dumping out transmitter in darkness. When you expose the cell to light, that triggers a series of biochemical reactions in the outer segment. And we'll talk about those biochemical reactions in a second. The end result of those reactions is a closure of some of these channels in the surface membrane of the outer segment and a decrease in the circulating current. Okay, so this current decreases. That allows the cell to hyperpolarize a bit. And that hyperpolarization causes a decrease in the amount of transmitter that's released from the synaptic terminal. Okay, is that clear to everybody? Pardon me? So light comes in, and it's absorbed by a photopigment molecule, and it triggers a series of biochemical reactions, and I'll talk about those in a minute. In the end, those biochemical reactions lead to a closure of channels, and we'll talk about the details of that in a second. Okay, any other questions about sort of how they work? Okay, so this circulating current is actually very convenient for us experimentally. We can measure this circulating current and its dependence on light simply by drawing the cell into a tight-fitting glass electrode. And an example of that is shown here. Hopefully this... Yeah, so they operate between minus 40 and minus 70 millivolts. They never get more depolarized than minus 40. So they're very odd cells in that way. Very different than most other cells that you'll encounter. Yeah, so you need, whichever direction you do things in, you need continuous release because you want an output that's continuously graded with the amount of light falling on the outer segment. So I don't care how you do that, but you need some continuous mapping of light to transmitter. There are several ways of going about doing that, but... So, yeah, so if we think about a rod working at higher light levels, or a cone in particular, the cone operates in basically the same way, then we have a continuous time-varying light falling on the cone. And that gets converted into continuous changes in transmitter release from the synaptic terminal down here. Right. So you have, yeah, so you have, so at some level it's not completely continuous, but you have multiple sites for release in the synaptic terminal. You probably have on order a couple hundred. Each of them is refractory. Pardon me?
Per single receptor,
yeah. A couple hundred sites where you release transmitter. So the refractory period only affects a single one.
The refractory period is not for the adoption for these molecules that absorb the photons until they recover.
No, we'll get to that. So a rod has something like 300 million rhodopsin molecules.
Okay.
It has a lot.
Okay.
So there's really no issue of depletion of rhodopsin molecules or any of the biochemistry in the cascade under low light level conditions. Okay, so for all the things that I'll tell you about how rods work, there's really no issue of refractoriness. And it's just because of the sheer numbers. Okay. Yeah. Pardon me? It's glutamate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I can talk a little bit more about what it... it actually acts both as excitatory and inhibitory on two different types of postsynaptic cells. It turns out, a brief digression, but it turns out that vision treats increments in light intensity and decrements in light intensity separately. Okay, so you have a set of circuits that are set up for, this is an increment in light intensity about the mean, and a parallel set of circuitry that's set up for decrements. The increment and decrement pathways are set up by the postsynaptic cells to the photoreceptor. And it's set up exactly by the action of glutamate on the postsynaptic cell. Okay, so there's one cell, if the rod hyperpolarizes, there's a postsynaptic cell that will hyperpolarize with it. One type of postsynaptic cell called an off-bipolar cell. There's another type of bipolar cell that will depolarize when the rod hyperpolarizes. That distinction, and we call that, we call those on and off pathways. The separation of vision into on and off pathways is carried through throughout the system, but it's set up right here at the photoreceptor synapse. Okay, so how can we measure these circulating currents? Hopefully this shows up. Yeah, you can see that, okay. So this is a little piece of retina from a primate, from a monkey retina. The retina's been kind of pulled apart, and there's a little chunk of retina here that might be 100 microns across. And here you can see a single rod outer segment projecting from this piece of retina. We suck this outer segment up into this tight-fitting glass electrode. Okay, so we move the electrode up to the cell, basically vacuum the cell up with it. So here's the outer segment in the glass electrode now. And what that electrode serves to do is collect the current that was flowing into the outer segment. Okay, so we basically busted that little current loop and forced that loop to flow through our electrode, through our electronics, and then back into the bath and through the inner segment here. Okay, so the electrode collects the current, and we can directly monitor changes in this current in response to light. Okay, so this technique was introduced, I don't know, it's like 25 years ago now by Baylor Lamb and Yao. It's proved a really good way to make stable, long-term recordings of light responses in these cells.
So what kind of leak resistance do you have?
You at best, maybe 20 megaohms, like that. Now, I'll show you an example where what kind of limitations that imposes on these recordings.
And the aspect ratio of this primate rod, that's different from the cell?
That turns out to vary, yeah. So I should point out that everything is quite a bit smaller here. The primate rods are about 2 microns in diameter. So, you know, things are fairly small at this point. And the other thing I should point out, we do all this under infrared light, so we don't stimulate the cells while we're doing the recording. So we can maintain everything under really dark adapted conditions.
So the length is the same, but it's narrower?
Yeah. Yeah. Because we use infrared light that's ineffective in, so for the same reason you can't see infrared light, the cells can't see it either. And then we've got an infrared sensitive camera which is projecting to a monitor, and we're doing everything on the monitor. And everything we're really careful about that, because you don't want to confuse. You don't want to take the tissue, get it dark adapted, and then light adapt it for doing the recording. So, you know, we invest heavily in night vision equipment, and, you know, if the military comes out with a new night vision goggles, we're the first ones to get them, and because that means we can turn down our light sources. So this is all, you know, these pictures are all taken using light that's a micron or longer. And the cells are optimally sensitive at 500 nanometers. Their sensitivity to micron is down by something like 13 orders of magnitude. So we can deliver a fair bit of light at a micron and not stimulate the cells at all. Okay, so what I'm showing over here are recordings from this, using this approach. So what's plotted here is the current that's collected by the suction electrode as a function of time, with the flash given here at time zero, and I've superimposed average responses to a number of different flash strengths. Okay, so the dim flash here is something like, on average, 2 absorbed photons, and each successive flash, I think, is twice as bright as the previous one. This is, we're not actually clamping the voltage of the cell. All we're doing is breaking this current loop. Okay, so we've put our suction electrode over the cell here. Rather than flowing in a loop like this, the current flows down through our suction electrode into the cell and out of the inner part. The voltage can change. The voltage inside the cell can change as it wants to. The current can change as it wants to. All we've done is not permitted the current to flow in the extracellular solution around the cell and forced it to flow through our electronics. Okay, so it's different than sort of either voltage or current clamp recording.
So it's like getting out of half the ground is getting an ammeter.
Right. Right. Yeah, all we've done is make this really high resistance and provided a lower resistance pathway for the current to flow that happens to go through a current measuring amplifier that we're monitoring the output of. So we're both collecting the current with the suction electrode and returning it to the bath through a ground electrode. And the resistance of that pathway better be less than the resistance of this pathway. That's the trick to the whole procedure. Okay, so there are a couple things. So first of all, we can get nice recordings from the cells, and the cells are clearly producing responses that are graded with the strength of the flash. if we deliver a really bright flash here, the reason the current comes down to zero is we've shut all of the channels in the surface membrane of the outer segment. Okay, so we basically shut the current down completely. And that's why this comes down to zero and why it's got this kind of clipped off top. So a couple things about these. First of all, I said that the smallest response there was to flash that on average was a couple absorbed photons. But these are all average responses. And the second thing is the bright flash here is kind of like you sit in a completely dark room and then a camera flash goes off. It's way beyond the normal range of rod vision. Okay. So what we're really interested in is how the cell works down at these low light levels and not how it works on average, but how it works on individual trials. Okay? So if we simply same recording and deliver a series of very dim flashes and look at the individual responses, we see that these are quantized.
The flash is 100 milliseconds.
In this case it's a 10 millisecond flash. Yeah, and so actually so let me
so it still goes up after.
Right. So yeah, so let me make a point about the time scale here, because something that you pick up all the time is, so these are like 500 milliseconds long or something like that, and these are from a primate rod at 37 degrees. Should be very representative of what rods in our eye are doing under dark adaptive conditions. And the first thing you get alarmed by is 500 milliseconds sounds like a really long time for vision. It turns out that is a real property of our visual system. If you get dark adapted, your visual system slows way down. So I think if you set the refresh of your monitor to 5 hertz and you put on a lot of, you know, put on sunglasses, get dark adapted, you won't notice that the monitor is flickering. Your visual system, as you dark adapt, will slow way down, and the flicker fusion frequency, that is how you fuse flickering lights into lights that appear to be constant, will come down to something like 3 to 5 hertz. So this 500 milliseconds, although it seems long, is actually representative of kind of the kinetics of the responses of our visual system under dark adapted conditions. As the lights come up, if you apply a steady light to these cells, the responses become faster, and the responses of cones are much faster than those of rods. Okay, so the cone responses would reach a peak in something like 30 to 50 milliseconds, and the entire response would be maybe 80 milliseconds long. And that jives more with your notion that flicker fusion for cone vision is like 60 to 80 hertz, and that's why you set your monitor up in that range.
The response duration for cone and normal light, you say, is something about 30 to 40 milliseconds?
Yeah.
The rise time. The what? I thought that's the rise time. There's still some decay, right?
There's some, yeah.
The rise time is 30 minutes?
It's about
the scale of this one, right? How much is there?
The cones are something like 5 to 10 times faster than these, and it depends on the mean light level. So if I turn up, if you're in a fairly bright mean light level, then the cones are still faster than that. Okay, so the duration of the response is quite dependent on the mean light level. Yeah, and it'll come down to like 30 milliseconds or so, probably under more or less conditions like in this room right now, probably more like something like 30 milliseconds.
Is there any ecological reason for that?
For why things speed up?
For these different
Yeah, I'll talk about what we know about that in a second, and it's something we can also pick up informally. So I'll mention what is going on, and then we can talk in more quantitative detail about that if you're interested in it.
And it's interesting that the rise time here is 10 times longer than the actual flash. I mean,
yeah, and I'll talk about exactly why that.
Yeah.
I mean, these are impulse responses, effectively, right? We give a very brief flash, so the flash is not affecting the kinetics. And these are the impulse responses of the system. And they are fairly slow, and I'll talk about where that comes from. Okay, so I said we wanted to look at individual responses to dim flashes, see what those look like. And one of the things that we see when we do that is that the responses are quantized. So here, this again, this should be one picoamp. That label got lost. So this is current collected by the suction electrode as a function of time. And now we're delivering 10 millisecond flashes at each of the times indicated here. Okay, and what you see is that sometimes the cell generates a response, that on some trials it fails to respond. It usually generates a response of a similar amplitude, and occasionally we get a larger response. It's exactly what we expect from Poisson statistics. If I deliver a flash that produces, on average, one absorbed photon, it'll produce zero sometimes, one sometimes, two some other times. Okay. If we extend an experiment like this and collect several hundred or a thousand responses, we can nicely predict the number in each group from Poisson statistics. And that's what's shown on the bottom. So what's plotted here is simply measure the peak amplitude of each of these responses and just make a histogram of those peak amplitudes. So number of responses observed as a function of their amplitude. In this case, we've done the same thing for three different flash strengths in the same cell. That provides us with a better test of Poisson statistics. Okay. The stepped curves are the experimental histograms, and the smooth curves fit to them are histograms computed from assuming that the number of photons absorbed is described by Poisson statistics, assuming that there's some noise and darkness, so that gives rise to the width of this peak centered around zero. So these are the events like these here in which we get no response. So there's some dark noise that gives us the width of this peak, and there's some variability in the single photon response that gives rise to the width of that peak there.
Dark noise is less than one. I don't know.
Pardon me?
If this is the difference between one, zero and one photon, what's the reason that the dark noise, which is a fraction of photon?
So, right. So the dark noise is, it's usually about 20 to 30%. Of the amplitude of the single photon response. And the width of this distribution has to do with both, and again we'll get to this in a little bit, has both to do with noise in our recording and just fluctuations that the cell is generating in darkness. And we'll talk about where those come from in a minute.
Dark noise would be an event like this?
Dark noise would be, so all we've done here is make a histogram of every single time we deliver a flash, look at the amplitude of the response after the flash. So the dark noise comes, say, from these trials in which the cell didn't generate a response. Okay, so I give a flash, say this one, I look 200 milliseconds after the flash, measure the amplitude in a little time window there, and it's on average zero, but it fluctuates.
Well, which event there would you call a single photon event?
These.
No, but all of those are single photons. They're not. There's a huge variation in the amount of current.
So, and that variation is reflected by the width of this peak here.
You think the amplitude is not the area of the
response? Pardon me?
You think the amplitude?
Yeah, I'll show you an area histogram in a little bit.
Some of those are not two-photon events?
This one, I think, is a two-photon. Yeah.
And then the other ones are one-photon?
Yeah.
And then the small fluctuation of dark noise?
Right. And the evidence, so you could worry that we're not associating the right thing with. The evidence that is the right association comes from the number in each group scaling in accordance with the Poisson distribution. Okay. So
you see the dark noise is additive?
Yeah. And we can test that. That's pretty easy to test. Yeah?
So with the three plots, there was always still one photon further. We don't have any actual photons, so it's 4 kilograms.
Yeah, I mean, we begin to see a little bump out here. It's hard to separate that from the single photon bump. But you can sort of see the whole distribution sliding its way over as the flash strength comes up. And that's because the likelihood of getting an event, a couple photon event out here.
So 1.06 is the mean of the Poisson distribution that you've got in the fit.
Yeah. And, oh, no, sorry, one point, so these are fit. We know how much we turn the light up between these. Okay, so these are not independent fits to each of these. There's a single free parameter, which is basically the collecting area or quantum efficiency. And they're all fit simultaneously. So, that provides a much tighter bound on whether things are really obeying Poisson statistics. And you can try fitting them with different assumptions, like saying that maybe these things are two photon events and the fits are just awful. You can't come anywhere near these fits from that. Okay, let's see what else I want to say about that. Okay, so first of all, this is telling us that we can observe single photon responses from single rods. And the evidence for that is, first of all, just visually, the responses look quantized. And if we fit them and look at the distribution of the response amplitudes, we find that that obeys Poisson statistics. Okay, so the cells are responding to single photons. And from these fits, we can get an idea of how much variability there is in the single photon response. And I'll come back to that in a little bit also. Yeah. Right. So the intensity changes the number, it pushes our distribution over such that we're more likely to get single photon events or two photon events. But it doesn't change the width of this peak. It changes the number of events that go into this peak, because you're less likely to get a failure. But the width of this peak is identical in all three of those cases. In fact, that's another constraint on the fit, is that those... Yeah. So the dark noise distribution isn't changing, but in this experiment, the likelihood that you get a failure on a given flash scales with the strength of the flash.
So the model is a Poisson ball with a Gaussian.
So the model, I'll come back to this, so let me just quickly go through that. There are actually two Gaussians, which is why, there's one for the dark noise and there's one for the single photon response. So, the model is the probability of seeing response of a particular amplitude is there's a failures peak. There's a singles peak and a two photon peak. So the area under each of these peaks should scale with as a Poisson distribution. Right, so Poisson statistics tell us the relative area of these peaks. There's a width here, which is the dark noise. There's a mean amplitude of the single photon response. And there's a width of this peak. Which includes some dark noise plus some fluctuations in the amplitude of the single photon response. Okay, so we're assuming that we have additive dark noise and variability. And the width of this peak has the dark noise plus two of those and so on.
The higher peak, you look wider on those.
Right, right. And the reason they're spreading is because, you're getting variability from successive single photon responses. So one of the things that this gives us a measure then of is the variability in the single photon response compared to its amplitude. And I'll come back to that in a little bit, talk about it. But one of the reasons that's interesting is these are signals generated by single molecules. You expect to see stochastic fluctuations in their amplitude, and we'll come back to that and talk about how large they are. Okay, so let me get through just maybe two more things and take a quick break. So let's think about what the sort of functional requirements are for the rod to be able to do this, that is to produce these single photon responses. So one thing is these have to be highly amplified. So these are responses that are generated by activation of a single molecule. If we integrate under one of these responses, remember this is current that's being suppressed, so it's charges that are failing to enter the outer segment. If we integrate under one of these, we find that there are about 10 to the 6 charges that fail to enter the outer segment during the course of the single photon response. So you've taken this activation of a single molecule and turned it into a nice big macroscopic electrical signal that, you know, even we can come in and measure. And we're really making use of that in making these measurements. So that's one thing. The dark noise has to be low, right? These things need to stick out clearly from fluctuations in the baseline. And finally, there's this issue of having reproducible or stereotyped single photon responses. That is, that the variability in the single photon response itself is relatively small. And I'll go through each of those and talk a bit about what we know about how each of those works. So let me just talk about the amplification, and then we can take a quick break. So I mentioned a little while ago that these single photon responses were generated when a photon is absorbed and it triggers a series of biochemical reactions. We know quite well from combined efforts in biochemistry, molecular biology, and physiology, who the players are in that biochemical cascade. And you should think about this as a little molecular amplifier that's generating these nice big electrical signals. So here's sort of a diagram of how this works. So again, there's something like 10 to the 6 charges that are making up the single photon response. And that's because of this cascade of amplifying steps. So what I've done here is taken a little piece of the outer segment. We can blow it up and we can look at what's happening inside. And there's this cascade of reactions that couples absorption of a photon by the photopigment molecule, which is rhodopsin in the rods. It couples absorption of a photon to the changes in currents that we measure. And the way this amplification works is the following. So light comes in and activates rhodopsin. It activates it by twisting a bond in rhodopsin and putting it into a catalytically active state. And I emphasize that it's catalytically active because what it does is it acts as a substrate for the activation of another protein, a G protein called transducin. So the important thing there is that rhodopsin can repetitively activate transducin. It can activate something like thousands of copies of transducin while it's active. So you've got a bunch of amplification there. The G protein goes off and activates another enzyme called phosphodiesterase. This step is a one-to-one reaction, so it's just a protein-protein interaction without any amplification. The phosphodiesterase also acts catalytically. That is, it can hydrolyze many molecules of cyclic GMP during its active lifetime. So something like a single PDE can hydrolyze something like 50 cyclic GMPs. The cyclic GMPs are a diffusible compound within the outer segment, and they're the ones that hold these channels in the surface membrane open and permit the current to flow into the outer segment. Okay, so cyclic GMP is like the doorstop in a door. If you activate all this stuff, so light comes in, activates rhodopsin, and so on, it reduces the concentration of cyclic GMP. It's like pulling the doorstop out of the door, and the door swings closed, and the current decreases. That's the signal that we're measuring. Okay? So the amplification comes by virtue of a series of steps, each of which involves some kind of multiplication of the number of components involved in the response. And the last thing I'll point out is the cyclic GMP needs to get restored. And we can't just eat it up. It needs to also get restored so the responses come back down. And there's another molecule in the outer segment called guanylate cyclase, whose job it is to make cyclic GMP. The other point that I want to make here is we know a good deal about the players in this transduction pathway. We also know a lot quantitatively about how these interactions work. So we know the rate constants that govern these interactions. And we know those well enough that you can write down a set of differential equations that describes in detail how this transduction cascade works. And you're not sort of, it's not a set of differential equations with lots of free parameters. It's tightly constrained by experimental measurements of the underlying rate constants. So it's a case where we can generate models for how the system works, which are very tightly coupled to the underlying biochemical measurements. And if any of you are interested in that, we can go through kind of that process and how we can write down these differential equations and what good they might do for how we study this transduction process. So if you're interested in that, just grab me sometime later and we can go through that.
I skipped
this here in terms of simplifying things a little bit, but it turns out that all of these initial reactions, so rhodopsin activating transducin and transducin activating PDE, all happens in 2D. So it happens on a membrane. And probably that's to reduce time of diffusional encounters between these components. And there are actually some very nice experiments recently where you can go measure these diffusion times and you can manipulate them a little bit and show that it affects the kinetics of the light response. So in particular, it turns out that rhodopsin is present at such a high concentration that it controls its own diffusion time in the membrane because you almost formed a crystal on the membrane. If you reduce the rhodopsin concentration, you can speed up the light responses a little bit. And the reason that's likely to occur is because you've increased the speed of all of these subsequent reactions. Since they're all basically operating at or close to the diffusion limit. Yeah, so all of these components are just freely diffusing around in the membrane. And the thing that couples this stuff to the surface membrane. So this stuff is to make it clear what the two membranes are.
Are you going to talk about this in depth, or is this the last slide then?
I wasn't going to talk about it in much more depth, but... If you want me to, I can. Your pick. Let me just say a little bit about if the rod outer segment is like that, there are disks within, membrane disks within the outer segment. And the rhodopsin is diffusing around on the disk. And transducin is on the disk. And the PDE is also on the disk. What couples the disk to the surface membrane is diffusion of cyclic GMP. And that diffusion is happening in solution. Okay, so that's the soluble compound that's diffusing from the disk to the surface membrane.
This is
Pardon me?
Where the whole stack inside that.
Yeah. So they're actually, they're like 3,000 of these disks in the rod. They're just stacked up on top of each other. Okay, so I wanted to leave.
The disk is supposed to align the rugosa molecule so it's oriented in the right direction. Is that true?
There are polarization effects on the light response, which are likely due to the alignment of rhodopsin in the disks. So the cell is more sensitive to one polarization of light than the other, and that. So it does line the rhodopsin up. Whether that's okay. Why it is there is less. Okay. I think of it more as being there to make diffusion a 2D problem rather than a 3D problem, and it increases all those diffusional encounter rates.
So the first step has much higher gain than the second step.
Right.
And is it much slower?
What's the speed? Yeah, so likely the rate limiting step for the entire light response is the shut off of activated rhodopsin. So I said this thing is acting as a catalyst. So it's sitting there active, and while it's active, it's activating these G proteins. It's likely that the limiting step for the light response is decay or shut off of rhodopsin itself.
Well, there's two aspects. That would be the decay, but then the rise time would be how long it takes to produce 1,000 activated transducers. So if it goes through one by one and starts activating these transducers, then the rate of that.
The rise time is actually, so as long as all of this stuff is working at a higher rate than this thing, then cyclic GMP is decreasing and the current is continuing to rise. So it's only when this stuff has decayed to a level that this thing can exceed it and the cyclic GMP can increase that's where you reach the peak of the response. So it involves shutting this stuff off to get the response to reach its peak and come down. The slope of the rise is determined by I don't know if we really know what the limiting step is there. This reaction is supposed to happen in about a millisecond. Each one of these happens in a fraction of a millisecond. I don't think it's really understood what it is that's rate limiting for the slope of the rising phase. You have, let's see, so there are 10 to the 8th rhodopsins per cell, and there are 3,000 disks per cell.
And then, the activation of one photon, what does it imply? One molecule?
One rhodopsin is activated, and that's enough to activate some fraction of the molecule of the transducing molecules that are on the disk, but not.
Is this going to cause all 10 to the 4th charges per second? But you say that the quantum is 10 to the
6th. Yeah, so this accounts for something like 10 to the 4th charges per second, but there are about 100 channels that are. Right. And so actually, there's an important general point there, which is the only case where you have a single molecule that's involved in the response is that rhodopsin. So as soon as you get downstream, you always have, on order of several hundred. And that's probably important because the stochastic fluctuations in all of the downstream components are relatively unimportant. There are a couple of components of the dark noise, and I'll talk about those in a little bit. So should we take a 10-minute break and then? Okay.
have?
I can go however long
you think. If you take a 10-minute break, then it's only an hour more until 12:30. It looks like you have a lot of material.
Yeah, but I can pack it into an hour.
Right.
I'll just, it seems like the right thing to do on this is just to go at whatever pace.
Okay.
Is right.
All right. Well, this is great. This is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get as far as I get.
Okay. Thank you.